My guest today, Pedro Longshoreyan, is the chair of the Department of Latin American Studies at the University of San Francisco, specializing in Latin American contemporary narrative and critical theory. His areas of academic study include Latin American literature and culture, film studies, urban studies, comparative literature, and critical theory, particularly psychoanalytic theory. In 2001, he co-authored and co-edited Postmodernity in Latin America and a reader published by Humanity Books. An article of his in that book was singled out as an important contribution to understanding the neo-Baroque aesthetic in Latin America and its relation to the global discourse on postmodernity. He has also written and directed a number of films, one of which, Visitas, a full feature narrative that explores violence in Colombia, was an official selection in international festivals, among them Montreal, Toronto, Austin, Chicago, Grenada, Cartagena. What's particularly relevant today is discussion is that he is also a native of Venezuela, where his parents still reside. Welcome, Pedro Longshoreyan, once again to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. I'm glad to be here.
But, you know, by amazing coincidence, when we last spoke about the crisis in Venezuela, it was a year ago tomorrow. President Maduro had just packed the country's highest court, and Venezuela seemed even then on the verge of collapse. And now, a year later, it's disintegrated much further, with rioting in the streets, empty shelves in the stores, its currency worthless, and vultures and supporters of the regime on the outside assigning blame and figuring out what, if anything, could be done. How, Pedro, did the Bolivarian Revolution descend to this?
Well, it's a combination of things, right? I mean, they took the worst of the socialist model, which is a kind of an extreme centralization, a process of expropriation that was absolutely crazy. 7,000 industries were expropriated by the Chavismo system. And these were industries which produced a number of items in Venezuela that we're now importing. And we are now importing with less money. You know, Chavez believed that he had faith, blind faith, that the barrel of oil was going to be at $200 or $250 per barrel, and he budgeted with that number in mind. And of course, the barrel of oil, after he died, plummeted to 40 bolivars per dollar. This is a one commodity economy, and now we have less money and less industry than we had in the so-called Fourth Republic, which is, you know, the republic that Chavez erased with the reformation of the Constitution, so on and so forth. So that's on the economic aspect of the equation. So during, I would say, around 2008, there were years in which people were lifted out of poverty, and that has to be granted to the Bolivarian Revolution. But they were lifted from poverty with a model that was not sustainable. Basically, you know, they gave people the fish but didn't teach them how to fish. So after that, while there was money, of course, you know, there was a lot of people that were able to do much better. But what he didn't create and what he didn't have in mind and what he didn't plan for was a process of an economic, a socioeconomic process to create social mobility, which is something entirely different. And then also, because of external pressure, I mean, we can't forget that. I'm very much against the Maduro regime and the Chavista regime, but there was a lot of international pressure on Chavez, you know, during the first years of the so-called revolution. You remember that in 2002 there was a coup d'etat. It was partly orchestrated by the United States, partly orchestrated by Spain. And what that did was, since it wasn't successful, it reinstated Chavez with even more strength in political power. And he began to develop, I would think, a paranoia, you know, that it was going to be deposed. And that led to the sort of authoritarian tendencies that we began to see in Chavismo from early on, and which are now an exacerbation in Maduro's government. So we have socioeconomic ineptitude, and then we have political process that became more prone towards authoritarianism, right? And this is basically what happened in the country at those two levels.
Well, today, where there is extreme pressure, external pressure on the Venezuelan government, and it was announced that by the Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez late last night that Venezuela is going to try to threatening to pull out of the Organization of American States. What effect do you think this will have, one way or another, on the crisis there?
Well, I mean, this is like a chess game. The government is playing with international pressure because he has feared for quite a bit Almagro's threat to actually apply Venezuela the democratic charter, right, and expel Venezuela from the Organization of American States. And this is basically a way for the Venezuelan government, so you're going to expel us, we'll expel ourselves, we'll pull ourselves from your unethical institution. Mind you, I know that the Organization of American States in previous situations has remained to a violation of democratic states, such as in the case of Honduras with Zelaya, and even in the case of Dilma Rousseff. That does not mean that the Venezuelan case is not an example of a flagrant, not only violation of human rights, as we're seeing now, but a flagrant violation of civil liberties and democratic rights. So I think Maduro is right in his campaign to apply sanctions to Venezuela and to pressure Venezuela and the Venezuelan government into into finding more democratic solutions to its problem, into dialoguing with the opposition, into recognizing the legality of the only body elected by the Venezuelan people, which is the National Assembly, and which Maduro has tried vehemently to undermine and to silence and to annul. But with this move, Venezuelans seem to be saying, so your threat is that you're going to expose us, is that you're going to expel us from the Organization of American States. Well, you know what? We don't care. We're going to pull. We're going to change. We're going to turn the tables. And we're now telling you that we're going to threaten to exit the Organization of American States. And by doing so, whatever pressure you thought that you could exert on our government is nulled. Right? So it's a political game that Venezuela is playing. And I think it's advised is advised, or it follows very closely Cuba's relationship with the Organization of American States, right? And Cuba was expelled from the Organization of American States, and the Cuban Revolution, quote-unquote, survived for all those years. I mean, what Maduro and his government has to take into account is that Cuba survived while expelled from the Organization of American States because the world situation was different. There was a Cold War. Cuba, for many years, right up to 1989 or a little later, had the support of the Soviet Union. But we're not in a Cold War. Venezuela is a country highly in debt. It's mired by an economic situation that is absolutely crazy, with 700% of inflation, with a lack or a scarcity of common foods and medicines, with a crime rate that is abominable. It's around 28,000 homicides per year. So the situation is different, right? Cuba could count on the support of that was a product of the sort of Cold War division of the world. Venezuela can't. So Venezuela is isolating itself more and more as they go by and exiting from the American States. I think this is a threat, but I don't know if it's gonna get there, because by exiting the Organization of American States, the country is pretty much isolating itself from the region and from the rest of the world as well.
It's really, I don't recall ever seeing a a collapse of a country to such an extent, to such a degree, that Venezuela's economy and society has seemed to collapse these days. And I'm just wondering, were there, of course, debates from the outside, who was responsible for this? And traditionally, the American left has blamed the United States for it. Interfering everywhere in the world, with a good history of that. We know what the United States has done in Guatemala. We know what they've done in Honduras, in Central America, Salvador, Chile. And we know that they did in 2002. But do you think the United States wants the situation to get this bad as it is? Is the United States looking for an excuse to send troops?
No. I think the United States policy in Latin America has radically changed from its interventionist policy in the 70s or the 80s. Or let me put this another way. I don't think the United States pressures through military intervention, in Latin America at least. It pressures through economic intervention. I mean, I do think that in 2002, the country pressure to have the coup that deposed Chavez for a couple of days, right? I mean, we remember that crisis, and there was a famous documentary that a revolution will not be televised, which sort of registers that whole thing. Apart from what went on inside that particular crisis, you know, in terms of Venezuelan politics. But there was a pressure from the United States, from Spain, to have Chavez deposed. But now, I mean, it's been almost two decades since, well, not quite, but over 15 years since that happened. And I think with Obama, Venezuela was pretty much in the background. The United States is sort of overextended in the Middle East to really care about Venezuela. And all they cared about is maintaining the flow of oil, which is 17% of American consumption, stable. So they don't want to disrupt that, and they don't want to become involved in a military conflict in Venezuela. So I think that those claims are ill-founded. Yes, of course, I think that the deep state, the CIA, you know, they keep a watch on every corner of the world, but I don't think there has been anything active or super proactive in order to go that route. I mean, you might remember that Obama, when was that? Yeah, towards the last years of Obama's administration, he stated that Venezuela was a threat to American states. You know, the State Department said that. But that became kind of a legal and political figure to freeze the assets of Venezuelan military, who had assets, ironically, in the empire that they so much detest. And I'm talking about Venezuelan military from the Chavez and from the Maduro regime. They had assets and bank accounts here in the United States, which were in cahoots with drug trafficking. So Obama found a way of freezing those assets by declaring Venezuela, you know, a threat to the United States. But beyond that, nothing really has happened. And of course, the Maduro government is absolutely anachronistic, because when you hear Maduro, when you hear his speeches, when you hear Chavistas talk, they have created in the imaginary of the people that support them this enemy, this nemesis, this monster, you know, imperialism. I'm not saying that the United States is not to blame for a number of things, but Venezuela is not Chile. What's happening in Venezuela is not what happened in Chile, right? But the Maduro government needs this nemesis. They need a nemesis in order to justify the sort of mess the country is in. But there is no proof to absolutely any flagrant, belligerent interference on the part of the United States in Venezuela. And I think this is important to stress, Because I think we need to understand that what's happening in Venezuela is a crisis made in Venezuela, primarily made in Venezuela.
Well, yeah, that's going to be, it's very hard to take for those who immediately see the America's fine hand in everything. But here we have a situation where in 2011, Venezuela's foreign reserves were $30 billion. 2015, they're down to $20 billion. And now they're down to $10.5 billion. How long can Venezuela continue to do this? And does it have any support from the outside? I mean, Cuba seems to be very, very silent, at least what I see from U.S. papers. Cuba had been dependent on oil from Venezuela. I suspect that is not the same status as before. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. I mean, the National Assembly put out some figures according to which Venezuela still sending Cuba 87,000 barrels of oil a day. In the meantime, we've had to import gas from Brazil and Spain. I mean, I'm talking about the country with the largest oil reserves in the world importing gas from Brazil and Spain because we cannot meet our internal quota. PDVSA is bankrupt because they haven't invested in the technological renewal of what was once before one of the largest companies and one of the most profitable companies in the world. I mean, we should be producing around 5 million barrels of oil per day. We're producing less than 2 because the company is bankrupt. And still, Venezuela is sending oil to Cuba, you know.
Amazing.
So it's incredible. And the country, you know, Chavez was, you know, was very suspicious of the dollar as the kind of lingua franca of international finances. So he bought a lot of gold. Now Maduro is trying to sell that gold, right? A lot of which is in reserve. So we're down to $10 billion in reserve, which is really nothing. We have a debt that we have to service. We service that debt that leaves the country very little money to import everything it consumes. Because in the ruination, the sort of centralizing tendencies of the Chavista economy perpetrated in the country, there are no industries left. Now we have to import, as I said before, what we used to produce and what we used to export, like electricity and beans and textiles, so on and so forth. We have to import all that with less money because our one commodity, you know, has fallen in the market. The price of our one commodity, our single commodity, not only has fallen in the market, but we don't have the capacity to produce more in order to compensate and balance our budget. So it's a huge mess. And that's why I think that the tide is beginning to turn. I mean, these threats, we're going to pull out of the OAS, Organization of American States, is, you know, it's a kind of a wounded animal, you know, trying to survive as death approaches. And I think that the tide is beginning to turn because there are far too many pressures. There are internal pressures, you know. There is a generalized discontent in the country. I mean, these tens of thousands of people that you see in the streets are not anymore middle class and upper middle class and students. There's tremendous discontent in the shanty towns and in the barrios of Venezuela, right? And Maduro is quite cognizant of that. Anytime one of their politicians visits one of the barrios in Venezuela, they have to get out of Dodge immediately because they're booed and, you know, the people hit their pants in disapproval. So this is very significant. So there's that internal pressure from the National Assembly. The country has run out of money. There are no medicines. There's no food. Maduro refuses to accept humanitarian aid from the Organization of American States and also from the UN, right? Because that would be conceding that the country is in dire straits. There's pressure from, you know, there's international pressure. Venezuela doesn't have a viable, strong support from a country like the Soviet Union, you know, back in the days when they were able to back Cuba and Cuba's antagonism, or the antagonism between the United States and Cuba. Cuba could survive because it could actually use the Soviet Union as a resource. The times are different. And there is a deep institutional crisis in the country. There is a deep discontent. I don't know for how long he can keep this on.
Well, it's interesting. I can just imagine what the reaction would be if Vladimir Putin offered a load to Venezuela.
But the thing, Jeff,
yes,
what's happening is that kind of Venezuela is happening on the side of his the historical itinerary in our days. You know, the world is very occupied with what's going on in the Middle East, with what's going on in North Korea, with you know, what's going on with Russia and its influence in different elections. So Venezuela, you know, it's on the news because the discontent is real, and you know, the manifestations and the protests are very dramatic. But politically, it's kind of and this is too bad, it's kind of an afterthought.
I could imagine, I guess Pedro Longshoreon from USF, we're talking about, I guess, Venezuela. What about emigration from Venezuela? Are people leaving it in floods or trying to?
Yes. I mean, there has been, you see, Venezuela has never been a country of migrant. There hasn't been a migrant culture in the country. People haven't left. People that left like I did. You know, I left as a student. I went to study abroad and then sort of found my way around and organized my life elsewhere. You know, most Venezuelans went back. And when they left as students. But now, in the last 10, 15 years, there has been a tremendous diaspora of Venezuelans and Venezuelan talent to neighboring countries in Latin America, particularly to Colombia, to the U.S., to Europe. Yes, Venezuelans are leaving the country. It's very difficult to sustain life there. But as I said, I do think the tide is beginning to turn, because they have no alternative, they have no money, they have, you know, considerable international pressure. What needs to happen, you know, kind of like a month ago, Luis Ortega, who's the Attorney General of Venezuela, and who is currently serving Chavista, said that Maduro's move to dissolve the assembly broke was unconstitutional. And this is significant because it shows that the seams are beginning to burst from within the Chavista movement. This woman is Chavista, and she spoke out against what Maduro was trying to do with the assembly by using the Supreme Court. A Supreme Court, which, by the way, was arbitrarily appointed a night on December 5th, 2015, when he knew that the Chavista candidates were not going to be elected for the National Assembly. So what Maduro did was he appointed, you know, arbitrarily 13 magistrates, among which is the president of the Supreme Court of Venezuela, who is a convicted criminal. He has two homicides for which he was convicted and imprisoned. This is the president of the Venezuelan Supreme Court, appointed arbitrarily in December 2015 in order to undermine the National Assembly. So they have no options, because there begins to be dissent from within the ranks of Chavismo. What Maduro has is a military power with him. People like Padrino López, who's the general commander of the army, is, of course, with Maduro. But there is also dissent from among the lower ranks of the military, because these people are also in dire straits. So I don't think that they are going to be able to sustain it for long.
Well, you have the situation where the court dissolved the assembly, and that caused people to come out on the streets, and the legislature had to reverse that decision. But there's this question of what the nature of the opposition. There are people writing in the United States who were Chavistas trying to say that the opposition is among the rich and the upper middle class, but there's not much of a history of the rich and upper middle class being out in the streets protesting in many countries, as far as I'm concerned. And when we spoke the last time, you said the opposition was much more broader than many people who supported Chavez see it in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is a center to right, center to left, and even leftist parties in the opposition. La Causa Radical, Radical Cause, a movement towards socialism, Movimiento Socialismo. There are many members of that party that are part of the opposition, right? And, okay, so the middle class and the upper middle class, I mean, that's misguiding, right? Because now in Venezuela, there is 82% of the population is considered poor. So I don't think is the middle classes and the upper middle classes. And, you know, I think Chavez was definitely an event in Venezuelan politics. I don't think we can go back to what Venezuela was before Chavez. I think that politicians in the future, in the sort of reconstruction, remaking of Venezuela, will have to take Chavismo into account. We'll have to take into account the reasons why people voted for Chavez. We'll have to take into account the sort of hope Chavez did give, you know, to the lower classes. So it's a very idiosyncratic case, the Venezuelan case. So I think it becomes oversimplified when it is looked through the prism or the optics of these binary politics of left and right. I think it's much more complex than that. And yes, people are in the streets. People are marching. So that internal pressure, the external pressure in a post-Cold War environment, right? The lack of money, the lack of resources the government has, and a sort of discontent and dissent that is beginning to emerge from within Chavismo, I think signals that the tide is beginning to turn for the Bolivarian Revolution.
Is there any individuals who appear to be standing out without compromise? Capriles, who is the leading opposition candidate, has been now barred for 15 years. That's an extraordinary decision. How popular is he?
I mean, he's...
He's lost twice in the elections.
Yeah, he's lost. Well, the first time he lost very closely. Maduro was supposed to count himself because there were doubts as to the legitimacy of Maduro having won the elections, and he promised to do a recount, which he never did. I mean, remember that the electoral panel is made up of Chavistas, right? So he lost, but after that loss, the opposition gained new impetus with a sort of overwhelming victory, parliamentary victory in the National Assembly. So it's either Capriles, I mean, the other leader is in jail as a political prisoner. It's Leopoldo López. Henry Ramos Alup, who's an older politician who's the president of the assembly, is also another option. I mean, the opposition will have to sort of come together, find a sense of coherence. The opposition has so far been extremely reactive, right? Reactive in the sense, we're against this violation of human rights, we're against this violation of constitutional rights. But the opposition will have to come together and produce a plan for the reconstruction of Venezuela, you know, that includes some elements of the Bolivarian Revolution. And I don't see that happening either. So that's a bit disheartening as well. But it will have to do so. Because I think I don't think this is this the Bolivarian Revolution, Chavismo, however you want to call it, is going to last much longer. I mean, there are presidential elections looming at the end of 2018, and if you if you really look at what the protesters are asking for. They're asking for regional elections, which were supposed to be held in December 2016. And Maduro simply said, there are not going to be any elections. And he said that because he knew he was going to lose all the states. I mean, that the Chavismo was going to lose all the states. So he simply canceled the elections, which is, again, another authoritarian move, which defines his administration more and more as a dictatorship. The point here, Jeffrey, there is another element, another dimension that complicates things. The Venezuelan military is deeply corrupt, is deeply immersed in drug trafficking. The vice president of the country, Mr. Lassami, is being accused by the DEA, the DEA, you know, for drug trafficking and for being complicit with a cartel, the Cartel de los Soles. The second most powerful person in the country can't leave the country, and this is Diosdado Cabello. So there are rumors that these people, including Maduro, and you know that that Maduro's Cilia Flores, Maduro's the first lady's nephews, are in jail in New York for attempting to smuggle 800 kilos of cocaine into the United States, right? And they left once, over and over, they left with their drug cargo from the presidential ramp. So the rumors, I hear rumors, you know, and I read the news, and people are saying that what the government is trying to do is to sort of negotiate an exit that gives them or provides them immunity, right? Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for them to go. They don't want to go to jail. But the opposition is very reticent to do that. Not only because of drug trafficking, but also because of the political prisoners, of the amount of people that have died, you know, in this protest. But they don't want to go to elections because if they lose the elections, you know, they lose the sort of shield that the parliamentary immunity or that, you know, presidential immunity gives Maduro and his people, and they can be judged in a court of law for a number of things.
Pedro, we've actually come to the end of a very depressing but interesting hour, and we're going to have to revisit Venezuela again with you. Thank you so much for enlightening our listening audience about the situation in Venezuela, one of the most complicated, depressing, and a very depressing world today. So thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeffrey. And there is hope.
There is hope. Keep hope alive. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.